afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining Hashtag No Limits. Hashtag No Limits is about people who society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. I am your host, Shelley Kino, and today my guest is Joe Duffy. Joe is an advocate as well as an author, and he has been in the world of special education for over 40 years. And so in just a few minutes, we are going to get to his story, but I want to do a little bit of businessy kinds of things first. So if you are watching this and you are watching live, give us a hashtag live in the comments. If you are watching it in replay, give us a hashtag replay. If you have any questions for Joe or myself or any comments at all, please put those into the chat. We will be able to see those. Please like or subscribe to the channel. Make sure that you share it. All of that stuff helps get this seen more and by more people. And the whole premise of this show is, as I said, that it's about people who society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, "We know who we are, but not who we will become." And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there's no better example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. The butterfly has to struggle to get out of the cocoon after it had dissolved as a caterpillar into its cells and reformed into the butterfly. That is no easy journey, but neither is breaking through limits that society has placed upon you. So Joe, thank you for joining me today. Welcome. And how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Shelley. Thanks for having me.
So Joe, tell us a little bit about yourself and some of what I was alluding to in the fact that you've been involved in special education for quite a while.
Right. Yeah, it really goes back to my freshman year in college. So that was 1969. I was in the seminary at the time. And after your first year in the seminary, when you have the summer off, you need to work. And the work has to be something to do with pastoral ministry. And I was studying for the Archdiocese of Newark, but I was a member of the Paterson Diocese here in New Jersey. My classmates, most of them were from Newark, and they were going to work at a special camp, Camp Fatima, which was a week-long residential program for both children and adults with special needs. And I sort of was saying selfishly, I wonder if my diocese has something. And I wasn't aware of anything, but I spoke to the vocation director, and he had me speak to Father Worthen, who was the then director of what we called the Department of Special Education. Now it's Catholic Charities in Paterson Diocese. So that resulted in my working at the Paterson Diocese summer-long residential camp for both children and adults with disabilities, Camp Alexander. So that just started my lifelong career that even continues today, even though I'm retired from my Catholic Charities work. I'm working now doing executive search, and some of that search has been for executive level and C-level positions for programs that provide services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. But from there, the program was just that was a time in the state of New Jersey and in the country when things were changing rapidly for special services. There was a big scandal in New York called Willowbrook, which then a young reporter, Geraldo Rivera, did an expose of this large state institution in New York. And that started covering deplorable conditions, poor staffing and quality of life and food. And so that started the deinstitutionalization movement across the country in New Jersey at the same time, which as part of that deinstitutionalization program that started the group home movement. And so at that point, I was thinking about leaving the seminary. I wasn't sure about that. So I got permission to live at Murray House, the first group home the Diocese of Paterson opened in Paterson, New Jersey in 1972. And that's today the longest standing still operating group home. There was another home that opened just a couple months before, but they closed about two years later. So the Department for Persons with Disabilities started the group home movement in 72 in New Jersey. And today they operate, I think, 13 homes, shelter departments, and apartments for adults with disabilities. One of my favorite stories from there is I always felt comfortable working in the area of special needs. Opening day, we took our first six residents to live with us at Murray House, and we had a debriefing that night in the home director's apartment upstairs when we, and I lived there also. And the director, Monsignor Worthing, came into the room and he was chuckling, having just said goodbye to the parents of one of the young women that came to live with us. And people asked him, "What are you laughing about?" And he said, "You know, Dolores's mother was asking him about that Joe Duffy." He said, and excuse my use of the word, you know, in the 70s, the word retardation was acceptable term. So she wanted to know what kind of retardation seminarian was. So apparently I fit in perfectly right at the beginning. As I said, I felt quite at home then, and I felt quite at home all the years. I left the Department of Special Needs in the mid-70s when I got engaged, couldn't afford to work for them. And so I went down the street to a local hospital and thought for the summer, stayed there for 21 years. But in 1997, I got a call from the bishop asking if I would come back to run all of Catholic Charities. So until I retired in 2016, I ran all the programs for persons with disabilities, for addictions, refugee services, adoption services, children's services, emergency services, that sort of thing. But never really strayed far from disabilities. And since I retired, I continued to do some consulting work in that area, and it's just been it's just one of the things where I got as much out of it as I gave over the years.
And you know, I felt that way about teaching, and you know about my book, Those Who Can't Right. Teach. And in my book, I say that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book, is because I felt like I learned as much from my students, if not more, than what I taught them, and it truly is a beautiful experience. And it's such a blessing to be able to do something like that, where you feel like you're getting more than what you're giving, no matter what the position is that you're holding. So that's wonderful that the Catholic Ministries or Catholic Charities does so much for all those different organizations and groups of people like you talked about. One of the things that you mentioned that I want to bring out first, there were lots of things that you said in that introduction that I wanted to bring out a little bit more, but I want to start with the fact that when you got involved with special education, we didn't have the federal law yet. Right. The federal law didn't come into play until 1975. Mm-hmm. And that's the education law. Now, the Americans with Disabilities Act, I think that came in 73.
Right.
And then the special ed law was in 75. I mean, I get the dates confused sometimes. But you talked about institutionalizing. So what was that like for you going from being in an environment where people with differences, disabilities, special needs, whatever term you want to use, were really looked at so vastly differently than the general population, and I know that's a long span of time, but to where we are now, and then we'll kind of get into more specifics as we go.
Yeah, it's almost, I think, as if a lot of this happened by accident. You know, the law came, and so that put something in place, which now 50 years later is quite different than how we started. But also, let me just talk a bit more then about how we started. You know, this, I mentioned Monsignor Worthing. He was the founder of our Department for Persons with Disabilities, and he was a parish priest when he started out. And really, how it started was in his parish. Parents started coming to him that had children with special needs and talked about their son Johnny, you know, got baptized and then made his first communion. But their daughter Mary, who has Down syndrome, can't. And so Father Worthing, his whole premise for how he started services was, I'm going to provide services where they're not being provided by someone else. So it started in the parish with special needs catechetical classes that enabled children with disabilities to be able to make their first communion and confirmation. But the people didn't stop. And then it was, you know, well, Father, and now Johnny's going to summer camp, but Mary with Down syndrome can't go to summer camp. There's no program for her. So that went to the founding of where I worked, Camp Alexander, for special needs children. And then talking about school, you know, Mary is getting ready for school now. She's five, but, you know, she couldn't go to nursery school. And so he founded the first nursery program in our diocese for special needs program, which he closed fairly soon after the Education Act passed. because at that point, the schools, districts were starting to pick up and they were offering a lot more services that we can provide. Now, we're providing that nursery without any kind of specialized standards or licensing of what's in a nursery school. And so when the state got better at doing that, we did close the nursery school. We continued the camping program for a few more years, but we really concentrated on the group homes. And even then, it was perhaps because of that deinstitutionalization program, not too sure what really got the law finally passed. But then overnight, we had to start providing services, and there was no set standards for group homes. And so we opened our first group home. All we had to do was get everybody that lived there to get their food handler's license. There was no license level for a group home yet. I believe we ended up getting a license for a boarding home for sheltered care, which was the same for any kind of boarding home, regardless of what a person's abilities or disabilities were. And so there really weren't a lot of criteria for who you could accept. And also there wasn't a lot of payment for them. So when we started the group home movement, most of the staff were unpaid. They got to live there for free and they could eat there. And so you can think of that population. It was young college age kids who couldn't live on campus and didn't want to live at home. And I think that's where we got our whole initial staffing for programs was really working with youth that came to live with us. And then they went on to get their degrees, primarily in special education, sometimes in counseling or rehab counseling from there. And I think I would attribute another great benefit to bringing people into the field what were programs like Special Olympics, which of course is still going on today, but Special Olympics it certainly provided a place where people with special needs could participate and feel good about themselves and what they're able to do. But it also exposed the general population, especially those volunteers who, again, were frequently younger folks, to special needs people. And so that just interested them in a whole range of services for people with special needs. And I even today, I have not been to a Special Olympics event in a couple of years. You know, I'd go regularly 50 years ago. And actually, I have a niece now in upper part of New York State, and she's an Olympic swimmer for Special Olympics, so I've been to them at her events. But my wife and I are puppy raised for the Seeing Eye Foundation, so we're like foster parents. We raise pups for the Seeing Eye. Wow. And the word went out, we want a bunch of pups to come to the Special Olympics Festival at Villanova University in 2 weeks. And so the whole campus was full of Special Olympians, but also of puppies running around on our leashes for the both the Olympians. I think it was as much for the students at Villanova, though. So this was in September. They were going through a shock of having lost their pups because they're home and they're living at school. And so youthful volunteers wanted to stroke a pup as much as the Olympians did. But just seeing those huge numbers, and that's multiplied by all across the country, what's going on with volunteerism. That's a way of drawing people into the field and letting people see and people with special needs and people with feelings just like anybody else, and they can have successes, and it's just good to see them. And prior to this movement, I think I shared with you when I talked to you last week, I don't recall going to the ShopRite or the A&P in those days and seeing someone with special needs, but you go out today and you'll see them all around. And that's, I think, a lot to do with the fact that, one, parents are now told it's okay and they can keep their child and their teenager and their adult can stay in the community and live with support and be out there. And so they're not to be hidden away in institutions. At the same point, you still see the cruelty, or not so much the cruelty, I think it's the ignorance of some people that still don't know how to interact. My wife told me a story. One of the side effects that has been a problem for us, minor to what everyone else has to deal with because of the pandemic, has been part of our goal and our purpose as foster parents with Seeing Eye is to get the pups out there in their first year of life to see every kind of sight and sound and get used to it and accustomed to it. And because of social distancing, one of our current pups hadn't been out as much. And she, as a result, has been very shy. And my wife took her out a couple of weeks ago. Actually, it was just before the Villanova event to a store. And there was a young gentleman who was probably on the spectrum with autism and saw our pup and let the whole store know that he saw our pup. And our pup quickly went under my wife's legs. Yeah. So my wife said, we have to get Leah out more to see people. And so we just jumped at the chance to have her go to the Special Olympics and be able to cuddle up close to anybody and everybody that was there.
Yeah, that's so awesome. So you mentioned a little bit about the training, the certification and that sort of stuff. So I've heard some stories and I don't know if the stories are true, but from your experience, when people were having to now teach students with special education needs, what was their training at the beginning?
Yeah, I don't know it from as much experience as I've had working on the adult end. But what I do know, again, when the law passed, everything had to catch up to it. And so there were certification programs for becoming an elementary or a high school teacher. There weren't a lot of certification programs, if any, for special needs. And so they had to be developed. And so I'm guessing that people were drawn into it because they were an available body. And they were grandfathered in. Today, I couldn't be a certified special needs teacher today because I was one of those people. I wasn't interested in teaching in a school. I was interested in working with adults who had aged out of the school system. Yet I got my certification without ever being in a classroom because they accepted my work at the Adult Center for Special Needs in lieu of a field practicum, which would not be acceptable today. And today, for all levels of certification, my wife just retired 3 years ago after some 40 years doing special education, they've gotten so particular on what subject matter you can teach at the elementary and high school level, special needs and not, that there's a lot more in place. But when this first happened in the mid-70s, there was very little to go on. And we've been moved since then. The emphasis then was on self-contained classes and separating those with special needs to now the heavy emphasis on to the extent possible keeping people in class with supports and only pulling them out for minimal amounts of times, which still gets some resistance today. There's still a lot of teachers see that as disruptive to the rest of the class. While a lot of work's been done, I think a lot more work still needs to be done. I saw that evident when I read your book and some of those case studies. My wife and I've talked many times, the burdens we've placed on teachers, and this is even before the pandemic, the stress they must be under right now just to manage their class and manage a class with special needs in it too, in a virtual environment, it's got to be particularly challenging. And God bless all of our teachers right now.
Yeah, amen to that. Absolutely. I am not full-time teaching anymore, but I still have many, many friends who are. And, when I get a chance to see them, which is very rare because teachers, we were always exhausted pre-pandemic because of how intense our careers are. But during, and I wish I could say post-pandemic, but I don't think I can yet, they're even more exhausted. And strangely enough, I was a full-time special educator for about the first 29 years of our marriage. And this year, my husband decided, I'm going to go into full-time teaching. During a pandemic, now is when you decide.
Well, we need them.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, as you were talking about how we are getting more specific and highly trained, I think is the verbiage that's used in the law. That is starting to shift right now, at least in my area, as far as how people are being qualified to be a sub and to be a full-time teacher. And I'm very proud of my husband for doing what he's done, but he was in the business world for all those other years of our marriage. And in the state of Illinois, where we live, he was able to go through a certification process, and he can only teach business-related classes at the high school level. But I understand that, you know, there are very short programs now for people that are leaving one industry and coming into education, and they're not getting, like you said, that in-class experience. They're not necessarily learning a lot of what they truly need to be in the classroom. And unfortunately, with the sub shortage, we're getting people with just barely out of high school getting able to be a sub. And some of these people are ending up being long-term subs. Mm-hmm. So they're in classrooms 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks.
Right.
And they don't know lesson plans. They don't know how classes manage.
And that adds to the burden of those administrators who have to really check what qualifications does this person, this sub, or even this permanent person have to teach.
Right.
And I'm guessing occasionally we get people with the wrong certifications in those rooms because they're just such short staff.
Yeah. And it's been a question that's been rolling around in my mind for a while now is, you know, we know we have a staff shortage, and that is definitely a bad thing. But is it better to have someone in the classroom so that we can say we have a person in the classroom, but who really doesn't know how to work with people in the gen ed room, but more specifically in the special education environment and all of the needs that can come along with all the different disabilities that are in our schools today? I don't know. I don't really know if one way is better or worse. I almost feel that it's worse in so many cases to have that person in there that doesn't know what they're doing.
I think so. I think I saw that in your book. You know, if someone, especially if it's a long-term sub, but even for, you know, a day or two at a time, if someone's not competent to do that, you know, that damage, it's got a multiplier effect, could take weeks, months, and in some cases years to undo. And so, you know, why don't we do it right the first time and not have to undo it?
It's unfortunate right now. It just really is. I mean, every industry that anybody that I talk to, it seems like no matter what industry they're in, they talk about having staff shortages. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, it's that, you know,
one of the things,
poison.
Yeah. Again, in my current position doing this executive search, I'm very much aware of this phenomenon called the Great Resignation that's going on that we're seeing. And I'm absolutely convinced, I haven't seen all the statistics yet, but very much related to the pandemic. People are just getting tired and they're ready for a change. And you know, we see that, two, in the number of openings that we're recruiting for, and three, in the a lack of available people because it's so competitive for all the openings. So we're not seeing the larger pool we used to have when we had an opening. We had many people to choose from. Now it's much smaller because a lot of folks just aren't interested in working in that field anymore.
Right. So let's talk about that a little bit. You mentioned earlier that you are finding those kinds of positions for people with disabilities.
Yes. I want to say yes. Not at the executive level. I'm not. But within those agencies, you know, that I've worked with, you know, we have tried to walk the talk, and so not just talk about hiring people with disabilities, but we've made accommodations and we've had folks working for us remotely and on site that has special needs, and quite successfully.
That's fantastic. And I do hear more and more of that as the years go on, and especially now that I am doing this and I am seeking out companies that are doing that and individuals who are, you know, working in whatever industry that they may be working in and being fulfilled in their life. One of the reasons for doing this show is for people to hopefully watch it and see all the things that a person can do rather than focus on, oh, well, they have this disability and so they're not going to be able to. I mean, again, going back to the book, the reason it's called Those Who Can't is because they were told so often, and it's not just the stories in my book. There's only 9 stories plus my own story in the book. But there are millions of people that are having these thoughts projected onto them that they will not become something or other. Yeah. And I'm glad to know that that's not as bad from your perspective as it once was.
Yeah. We just,
as you said, still so much more to go.
We just celebrated the retirement of one of our long-term employees. So he's, I'm not his exact age, but somewhere between 65 and 70. And he started out as one of our campers in the 70s. So came to camp, came to live with us and came to work with us. And he was one of our, you know, 24 plus years as part of our facilities crew, maintaining all of our facilities. And he ended up living in an apartment on our campus and still lives there now in retirement. And he's probably the only person with special needs that has a building named after him. the Danny So-and-So Facility Center, which we had the opportunity to build a brand new facility to keep all of our storage and maintenance stuff in. And since he was in charge of doing all that stuff, we thought it was fitting. You know, we try, and many of our homes are named after people. Murray House was named after a boy named Jimmy Murray, who died in the state institution. Camp Alexander was named after one of our first campers who also died in institutions. So we named a lot of our programs and facilities after that, and like other people, after donors. But we particularly want to recognize, and that's, if I could digress for a second, talking about people having opportunity for recognition. Our Murray House program, so that's the longest running program in New Jersey, the group home, 50 plus years, celebrated its 50th Murray House dinner dance. With 1,000 people at it in 2019, wow. A month before the shutdown. Ordinarily, we have about 300 or 400, but we decided when we were hitting the 50th that we wanted to push. And so we rented both floors of the facility where we had it. We had it streamed live, grouped upstairs and downstairs. But at that Murray House dinner dance, I liking it. It's sort of like the high school prom. And so a lot of our clients at that time didn't have the opportunity to go to their prom. So we have the Murray House dinner dance. Everybody gets dressed up and people have a chance to sponsor someone from one of our group homes to come. And then we give out the awards, just like we would give out, you know, humanitarian award of the year, except it's one of our clients. And we get up there and they're reading the bio of this person, all their accomplishments, you know, talking about their work at the adult center, at the workshop, or working for this private company, and their volunteer work in the community. They're a member of the Knights of Columbus, attending Rotary Club meetings. And so this year we're proud to honor so-and-so, and they come up and everyone applause. And you'd think you were at the Academy Awards presentation with some of the ceremonies that we put on for our people that we're privileged to serve.
That is incredible. That's just so touching and so necessary. And I would love to be, you know, a guest there sometime and watch that, because, you know, I mean, companies do that all across the country. You know, they'll have an end of the year Christmas party, right. And, oh, you know, so-and-so did this and so-and-so did that. And so, yeah, you know, I'm so thankful that there is that organization that you're part of that is doing that, because that is something I think we are very lax in. Is recognizing people just, you know, for lots of things that they do.
Yeah. You know? One of the other, I think, really very useful services that we provide, it's been going on for a couple of dozen years now, probably even more than 36. We call it our People Need Friends program. A lot of the folks in our group homes don't have any blood relatives, or do, but haven't been involved with them for a host of reasons. But they need family and they need friends and a long-term relationship. And so we try, and we had, I don't know the numbers today, it probably has gone down a little bit because of the pandemic, but we had over 100 volunteers pre-pandemic time when I was last checking, that are matched with one resident of our group homes. In essence, it's sort of like a big brother's big sister's
home.
Substitute family program. And in some cases, they still have family that are involved in different degrees, but they still have a friend. And so depending on what that residents' interests are and needs are. You know, that may mean a once-a-week phone call. It may mean a once-a-week visit. You know, one person in particular would be picked up every week, and they go to church, and they go out to breakfast afterwards, but involving them with their birthdays and their holiday celebrations with their family. So they become part of an extended family. So every resident, we try to pair with one other person that's going to have long-term. And I don't know what the stats are, but many of them have been with the residents for two and three, and now coming even on four dozen years, the same friend. So they've been away on vacations with people. They've traveled around the country with them, and so they're not alone. They're part of our own DPD family, but they're part of that family of that volunteer also. At my own wedding, and at that point I was running the adult program for disabilities for Catholic Charities, there was one particular woman that had a crush on me, and all the clients were invited to the wedding, and I was talking to her elder sister. She said, yeah, I'm really worried, you know, when it comes time for your wife to say I do, that Janie's going to come up and push her aside and say I do. But the clients got very much involved with our lives.
Yeah. So I take it she didn't do that, though.
She didn't do that. She didn't do that. I think her sister probably held her by the arm, and she was jealous. Every time we were invited over for dinner, I brought my wife with me. She would try to sit in between us. But,
aw, well, you know, that happens. That's interesting about, and it's a fact that I don't think is talked about enough, and I'm not sure why. It's probably because it's a sensitive and it's a sad concept to think that there are people living in these group homes that don't either have interaction with their family or don't have any biological family. Can you speak to that a little bit as far as why someone may want to place their loved one in that type of facility, and for those that do have that loving interaction with their family members, why wouldn't they want to have their loved one at home with them? Yeah. What's the benefit?
It's, again, I think it's a part of what's happened over the first 50 years, but prior to the 70s, before the deinstitutionalization movement started, I think the family doc was pushing someone that survived the delivery. Because at that point, with the technology available, a lot of folks didn't survive that had special needs. But those that did survive, the parents were told, you can't manage this. We're going to place the child. And so a lot of children were just placed. And that put a tremendous amount of guilt on family who thought that, one, they did something wrong, you know, that caused this to happen. And two, what kind of parents are they? They're giving that child up. And so there was a lot of guilt when they placed their child in institution, and it was hard to face them and go to visit them. And then the deinstitutionalization movement started, and they were told, now it's okay for them to live in the community. Well, they were told 20 years earlier, 15 years earlier, that it wasn't. So it opened up that guilt again. And in the current situation, I think a lot more parents are willing and desirous of keeping their child and their teenager at home, and they want supports for them. And it gets to a point where they're not being realistic in being able to meet the needs, and it's taking a toll on their health, on their family's health. And so reluctantly, they'll then look for a placement. And it's gotten a little bit easier. Actually, it's gotten a lot easier in New Jersey. It used to be, you know, you'd work and get yourself put on a list, and then you'd be called and say, so here's an opening, take it or leave it. And if you leave it, you're off the list. Nowadays, that doesn't happen. Once you get on the list for the level of care, when if you have the need, then you let them know, and they'll activate it, and you'll have a support coordinator to look for a facility or a day program, depending on whatever you need for that. Now, I lost track. I was answering the question. So I think
you're fine. You're giving good information.
I think today there are so many more supports for community living that parents have options. So, I know what I was thinking, but parents are also planning ahead. And I think it was covering your book with the case study with, you know, parents need, in many cases, to get guardianship of their own children when they become adults, because they can't legally speak for them. And yet, in many cases, the adult is not able to manage their own finances and manage their own affairs. So they need someone to speak for them. And if it's not going to be the parent or a brother or sister or an aunt or uncle. It's going to be a state representative. And so parents need to plan. And so parents are encouraged. And a lot of that planning goes on with the parents and the family. So who's going to take Jimmy when we're not here? And so it might be the older brother or sister, but sometimes they just can't. And so parents are asked, and there are services available. And I'm sure it varies from state to state. In New Jersey, there's a lot of services available. In New York, there's a tremendous lot of services available with support. So parents can choose that they want a respite program. They just need a couple hours a week for themselves to recharge their battery. So if someone can come in, or if their son or daughter can go to this respite facility for a couple hours or a day out of the week or out of the month or out of the year at a time, they're able to maintain with support services at home. But they can plan for a whole continuum. It's not a matter of you're at home or institution. It could be you're also in a supported apartment nearby where we can visit, we're not able to visit. And again, I think it's important, and hopefully other agencies are doing what we're doing. If there's no family that can be involved, then we're going to get volunteers that are going to be involved to become that missing support for the person as they age in place with us.
Yeah, and I think that's probably spot on what you talked about regarding the guilt and, you know, bringing up old wounds, so to speak. And I wonder if sometimes for those that did fight so hard to be able to keep their children at home, that they feel like it's almost a slap in their face for somebody to want to place their child in an adult facility like that. And so therefore they're offended in a way. You know, how dare you? We fought so hard for this. Mm-hmm. And I've seen, unfortunately, situations where friends have had to make excruciatingly painful decisions to place their child in a residential facility. None of the parents that I know, and I don't know a lot, but none of the ones that I know have ever done that just on a whim, mm-hmm. you know, because, oh, well, I want some more freedom, or, you know, it's not for the reasons that people on the outside think is the reason why somebody would place their loved one in a residential facility. And it is definitely guilt ridden. The families that I know, you know, that they have struggled after they put the person there, no matter the age. I mean, I've known people who had, you know, not put their child in until their child was out of high school. And then I've known people who have had to put their child in when they were still in middle school. So, you know,
yeah,
and it's super easy.
This whole experience has given me, a new way of looking at early in my career, the association for the GAP point was for retarded citizens. Now it's just called the ARC, and that's a nationwide group. But it was a parent founded group that wanted support for children with special needs, and very much parallel what we did at Catholic Charities, talking about camping programs and scouting programs and residential programs, sheltered workshops. The difference being that their boards, at least then and probably to some extent still are, heavily dominated by parents of mm-hmm. children with special needs. And as a young administrator working at Catholic Charities, but also having some of my peers working in the ARCs, we almost had an attitude about, you know, you don't want to work for the ARC because you have those crazy parents. But you have new appreciation as I worked in the field for, well, we need those crazy parents that were going to speak up for their kids. Right. If we had more of them, I think we would have had better things going on in the schools. And so you just have to understand and you know, talk about walking in my shoes and having the empathy. You try to do that and you can do that to some extent, but every family is different, the pressures they go through. And what's, you know, one can bear with their own psyche and their own family supports, another family might not. And we shouldn't have them judging each other or us judging them. We have to look at each family and what they're able to do and not do. And keep that in mind as we're trying to juggle, well, we only have this much money in the special ed budget for the school district. You know, we got to find a way to make it work for that family.
Yeah, and that's so key and something that I always say and something that I try to remind anyone when we are having an IEP meeting or I'm speaking with a school staff is that the two things that drive special education both begin with the same letter, and that letter is I, and it stands for individual or individualized. Right. And so no matter what we're doing, we need to be thinking about that individual and not the programs that we already have in place or the systems that we used with some other students or some other program that, you know, worked for this child or that child, because exactly what you just said, there, nobody is the same. What each person needs and to the level that they need it is different than everybody else. It doesn't matter if they have a disability or they don't have a disability. We all are different. We're made that way. We're uniquely made. So, you know, it's so important to me that no matter what I do, we're remembering that there's an individual. And in most instances where I'm involved, that individual isn't even part of the discussion. They should be, and they can be, but they're not. And so we're making decisions and plans and programs and things that we think are going to be good supports or good accommodations. And we haven't even asked the person who's going to have all of that stuff. I don't want to say happen to them, but who all the stuff is for.
Right.
And, you know, and I imagine it's pretty similar in the adult world as well. You know, we have these, you know, like you said, every home probably now has some sort of a board or an oversight committee or whatever it is, you know, that is saying, okay, these are the things that we need to be doing in order to make this work. And I get that, you know, because you have to have those kinds of things in order to cover the largest majority of people you can. But then you have to also remember that there are going to be exceptions. Every rule has an exception, I think.
Right.
And so, especially when you're dealing with people, you have to think about the individuals and the individual circumstances. And having a nice balance of parents and non-parents, I think, is probably the optimal, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
I think that's probably the best situation. Yes.
Yes, because, you know, myself coming in, I'm able to be a little bit removed, well, probably a lot removed from a situation. And so my emotions aren't mostly what's driving my decisions, whereas a parent may have more emotions driving their decision. And so having that, you know, like, oh, I can see why that would work, you know, or that would be necessary.
Yeah, it could make for very interesting board meetings, but I think that's fine too. You know, that word conflict is not something that should be avoided. And at the board level, sometimes they want that. But if you have a combination of consumers, parents, whether it's the parents or the consumers themselves, and other people on the board, you're going to get some people speaking from their experience, you know, their business experience, their legal experience, their professional experience, and from their lived experience with the parents. So you're going to have heart and mind clashing, but that's okay. As long as you do it respectfully, each side will come to some understandings and be able to come up, hopefully, with win-wins rather than having it dominated just by one or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree because, I'm not a confrontational person, but I don't run away from confrontation. And I know that, unfortunately, that seems to be, you got to have that rub sometimes in order to get the best shine out of a situation. And while it's not comfortable, I think it's part of life and it's necessary. So I want to talk to you a few more minutes, if that's okay.
Sure.
I'm very much enjoying this and I so appreciate all of your experience that you bring, because I haven't had a lot of people that have had it from your perspective. I know people, individuals who have gone from, in fact, James in the book. You know, he was born not that many years after the law came into play. And so, you know, I've seen that. But what are some of the things that we've improved upon, but that we still have a long way to go? So talk about the positives that have definitely occurred because of the law, but that we can still continue to improve.
Well, I think the positive is recognizing the benefit of getting children to school earlier. So just bringing it down to 3-year-olds, that was a big step right there. But that was a step. But then have the services for those 3-year-olds and their families. And yes, we're getting there, and we're a lot better. But we got to do a lot more. Yeah, and again, I saw that when I was reading those case studies, and I remember from my time serving on the Board of Ed in my own township here, that you have the school district that has to manage its budget. And the special needs students, while growing in New Jersey as proportion to the total population, it's still very small. And so the business people might think, we just look at the budget then by size, and so it should be smaller. But the law doesn't say that. The law says you have to have an individualized education plan at the least restrictive environment as possible. The school districts then, I think, still, and again, and not just my wife, but and many of our people that we grew up with working at that camp went into special ed. So I'm talking to other teachers all the time, too, that are seeing the resistance still. And I think coming from the budget's driving things, but not just that. And then teachers are being told they have to have students with special needs in their classroom that maybe don't want them there. And maybe it's because of ignorance if they had some more support. So I think we still have to do some support. But the one thing I would recommend, and again, I think from reading your book, it made me think more strongly about that. I would think still a good number of parents, perhaps most parents, are going this alone when it comes to dealing with the school district. And so they're thinking they're the experts and they're listening to them. And you know what? I think it would really be beneficial to have a third party in that room. And so encouraging parents to get connected to a SPAN program or whatever the special needs program, support programs you are. And if they have available, look for it and find an advocate that's going to go with you. And if you're able to learn on yourselves, but insist on your rights and don't apologize for doing that. Because if you give the school district permission, and they're worried about their budgets, and all too often, then they're going to take the path of least resistance and not do it. But you can exert your power. You can ask for your rights and demand your rights under the law. And I think for children with special needs, it's even more important. In the case studies I was reading in your book, well, maybe next year it'll be better. Well, weeks and months of going through heck in a classroom are not going to be undone. And so to try to get the parents to get connected, to have support with dealing with the school district throughout the entire time, and don't be afraid to be that squeaky wheel. Again, talking as a school board member, it was the parents that complained and kept saying it's not enough that got the services. And so in one case, I don't remember all the details, but flying with the family out twice a year to visit at the residential school that they wanted their child in, when they convinced us that we could not provide for the child in district. But if the parents aren't going to complain, so they need to get good at that. I think in the long run, the earlier they get services, but and then not to rest on the laurels, because then comes the next year, and who's the teacher going to be then? And again, if you can have, I don't know how the school districts are doing it now, if you can have the classroom aid person that's following the person from year to year as they go through the district, that's even better. But if you change from one class to another, then sometimes you start starting all over. But so not to give up, to stay connected, and once you become familiar with the law, just demand your rights. And if you're not familiar, get someone that is familiar with your rights that's going to help you get them. Because if you just trust the school district to do it, I don't think in all cases they're going to do it optimally.
Yeah, that's such great advice. And I don't know if you're aware, but that's actually what I do for my paying job. Is I'm an advocate or an education consultant to families and school districts. Because what I realized when I left teaching, I was very frustrated with the education system. Mm-hmm. And so I saw what you're talking about, you know, where so many parents, they didn't speak up at meetings, but yet they would come to me after a meeting or, you know, in conversations, just in like parent conference time or whatever. And they would talk to me about how they didn't really understand the IEP, or that they thought it was providing something that it wasn't providing, or that their child had a right that they didn't feel was being carried out appropriately. And I would try to talk to the people that I worked with. I would talk to them and try to get them to change, and nothing would necessarily happen. And so I was very agitated with the education system. And so I left teaching and I was going to just work with families. And then I got into the Master IEP Coach program and started hearing from people who were also going into that program that were teachers from all across the country. And there were parents involved in this organization as well. And these teachers were special ed and gen ed teachers, and they just didn't know what to do or how to do it, because their colleges were not training them to have all the knowledge and tools, or to even know where to look for that knowledge and tools. And so then I thought, oh yeah, I started my degree in general education, and I had one class out of my, you know, first 2 years that was at all related to special education. And that was just an overview of, oh, this is a genetic one, and this one's we're not sure about. And here's the categories of eligibility for special education, and this is what they all mean. But there were no teaching strategies during that class. And so I ended up with a dual certification. And if it hadn't been for me getting the special education certification, I wouldn't have had any more than that one or two classes. And so then I started thinking, oh yeah, no, the teachers are overwhelmed because they don't have the training that they need. They're not supported, like you talked about, in their school systems. Nobody's coming in and you know, being their voice and allowing them to say, I'm not sure what I'm doing, or I'm not sure how to go about this, because we as teachers feel like we can't say that.
Right.
So that is such a valid point, is you know, that the parents need to speak up and the teachers need to be able to speak up and say, I need training, I need help, I need support. I'm happy to try this, but I need support.
I think one of the challenges too, for the teachers is they're walking a fine line too. If they want to speak up, there might be a price to pay for doing that too, whether it's congratulations, next year you're teaching kindergarten. Well, I'm a third grade teacher. Yeah. But sometimes teachers that speak up put that at risk too. So that may be or why. That doesn't necessarily excuse it, but we have to. And to the extent that their union is strong or not strong, you know, if they have a good union that's going to support you, fine. If you don't have a good union that's going to support you, then they might be even more reluctant. I don't know how much more time, but I really want to share one more story if I could with you too.
Sure. Yep. Go ahead. You're good.
One of our residents at our group home, who's dead now, but I think it's typical of our approach that we take when we take someone in, that they become part of us, and there's not too many left from the original, but there's still a couple there that have been with us now for 50 years in one or more of our homes. But Walter came to us in the late 70s, and he came to us because his brother was called in California to let him know that his mother died and who's going to take care of Walter. So Walter probably would have been in the TMR classification in those days if he had been going to school. But he was already well into his adulthood. And so his brother came from California and went to his local church, which was a different diocese. But they said, you know, call Father Whirlin. And so Walter came to live with us. But prior to living with us, he was, I guess, the primary caretaker for his aging mother, and running out to get her groceries. But then during the day when he was out, he would, you know, sit on the park bench, fall asleep, and get rolled for his money. And so he came to live with us the first night. And I'm this young person's not much exposure yet to special needs, just starting my program in special ed at William Patterson. And Walter was very hard of hearing. He fell asleep on the couch. So I called over to him, didn't wake up. So I went over to him and just touched his shoulder and shook him a little bit. And he came up and punched me in the mouth. And so I learned from that experience, Walter can't hear you, but you could jump on the floor about 10 feet away to have him feel the vibrations to wake him up.
Yeah.
But Walter, you had to, sort of like the comedy thing where you have to yell at someone because they can't hear trying to communicate with them, except right. he could sort of relives very well what he wanted to. But he stayed with us until he died, and we moved him up to what we called the farm. We had a 100-acre farm that we had taken over, and we put the 1.3 group homes on that property. So he was living in one of those homes, and to the extent someone could, you know, even if they weren't working, they had an assignment. So Walter's assignment was to go out and check the mail every day. So he had to walk about a 200-yard driveway to this huge mailbox to check the mail. So one day in the middle of the summer, Walter comes back from checking the mail with a blanket in his arms and a baby in the blanket. And this was in August, and the police mentioned that, you know, at that time of day, that quickly would have gotten to 100-plus degrees. And so if Walter wasn't checking the mail, that baby would have died. And Walter thought that, and he kept saying, "My baby." He went and got the mail, and that was his baby. He didn't like the idea of having the state come and take his baby away. And so he talked about that for months when he told someone, "They took my baby, those GD police." So he would complain about that, and we forgot all about that. And fast forward about 15 years later, no, not 15, 20 years later, there's a knock on our office door. Some young woman wanted to talk to someone at our agency. She was that baby. And so she was trying to track down, and she was now in medical school. And so we have one more doctor today because of Walter. But we tried to give everybody in our facilities the opportunity and expectation that they can do what they can do. And that's what Walter could do. And Walter was able to make a difference in that life and in the lives of the people that worked with him.
Oh, Joe, that is such a beautiful story. And, you know, we don't know what our purpose is. Mm-hmm. We don't know what one action we will do that can change the world. And that just fits that so perfectly. Oh my gosh, that story really touched me. I thank you for sharing that. And like I said, what a perfect story to end on. And unfortunately, it is time for us to wrap up. I so appreciate you being here today and sharing your experiences and your knowledge with us. Next week, to my audience, I will have Catherine Witcher. She is the master of the master IEP coach mentorship. And she's going to share about, you know, how she started that, why she started it. And the main reason is because she is a sibling to a person with a disability. And so she's going to share what it was like growing up with as that sibling, because they are another sector that often gets forgot about. When you have someone in your family that has a special need. So Joe, quick last, anything that you want to say before we say goodbye?
Just thank you much for having me. Again, it was part of my life going back to those first experiences, and I'm sure it'll be part of my life through my deathbed. It's in the system, my system now, and it really has shaped what I've been as an administrator of a nonprofit agency, with such emphasis on respect for dignity of people from all walks of life and all abilities and disabilities.
Yeah, that's so awesome. Thank you again for joining me today. Very much appreciate it. Thank you for the book review. I love it. And I look forward to talking with you more. Thanks, everybody. Have a good week.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelley Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelley Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelley Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shelleykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shelleykino.com, SHELLEYKENOW.